Hi, Marco Werman here. We're all on deadline at The World. Our spring fundraiser has just 1 week left, so you only have a limited time for your contribution to The World to be matched by an anonymous donor. In order to take full advantage of that match, we need to raise $15,000 before May 1st. Fact-based journalism with a global perspective is crucial during these uncertain times. You can make our reporting available to millions of people with a tax-deductible gift to The World today. When you give today, your contribution will be doubled by an anonymous donor. That means $75 of support actually becomes $150. The World is freely available to anyone, on air, on demand, and on the web. It's always been our goal to report stories from around the world with nuance, context, and with voices of the people affected. Today, we ask your support of that goal. Help keep access to The World free for everyone. Please go to theworld.org/give and contribute today, while your gift will have twice the impact. We still need to raise $15,000 to take full advantage of an anonymous donor's match. Go to theworld.org/give or follow the link right here in the episode notes. Stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you. World leaders are in a tough position, shut down an economy to stop the spread of disease and risk something worse.
With this corona, now we'll die of hunger because we don't have money.
Also today, the coronavirus is believed to have started at a wet market in Wuhan. China is reopening these markets, and that upsets many in the international community. Others say they're basically farmers' markets.
What you will see is really just fresh produce, vegetables, fruits, and the conventional animal meat.
And cities everywhere are closing off their roads to cars, leaving the space to pedestrians and cyclists. Many hope these changes become the norm.
It's not a choice. It's an obligation for all earthlings to be slow.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. COVID-19 has touched every corner of the globe. The virus carries no racial bias in what it does inside the human body, but we are seeing statistics about the disproportionate toll on Black and Latino people across the U.S. What's the situation in the rest of the world? Health advocates say that's an important question, one that's difficult to answer. The World's Rupa Shenoy explains.
In the last few days, shaky cell phone video has emerged of the first hospital in Brazil to be overwhelmed with coronavirus patients. It's in Amazonas State, where many indigenous people live and where there are more than 2,000 COVID-19 cases. Doctors have complained about a lack of ventilators and protective gear. The video shows corpses lying on beds next to patients receiving care.
There are bodies of people who already died. They are on the corridors, on the halls of this hospital, waiting to be processed.
Tiago Amparo is a lawyer and professor in Sao Paulo, the epicenter of Brazil's coronavirus outbreak. He's been examining new numbers released by the Brazilian government about the demographics of coronavirus patients. He's seeing a disproportionate impact on indigenous people and a pattern that's also been evident in the U.S.
The number of Black people that died because coronavirus is larger than the white people.
Anyone can get the coronavirus, but there appear to be dramatic disparities in who actually dies from the disease. Amparo says that's clear, even though many Brazilian COVID-19 patients are listed as race unknown.
I'm pretty sure that most of those people whose race are not identified are Black.
That's because the number of cases is growing in poor communities where most people are Black. They depend on the struggling public health system, while richer people have access to private hospitals.
It's not a coincidence because, of course, we had 300 years of slavery.
Like the U.S., Brazil enslaved millions of Africans and their descendants for hundreds of years, and afterward allowed systemic inequalities to continue. Black people in Brazil are overrepresented in prison populations and face police brutality. They're more likely to have pre-existing health conditions because of a lack of access to healthy foods, or because their families lived in areas without basic sanitation or in communities exposed to pollution. Many have jobs like housekeepers and bus drivers, where social distancing is difficult. Yet Amparo says Brazil has resisted examining its racial disparities.
We are actually very far from being able to take race seriously and to see race as an important factor.
Amparo is part of a coalition of major black organizations in Brazil petitioning the government to require collection of racial data for coronavirus patients.
My fear is that as it goes on, this will become like an invisible disease, that we are not going to actually document it and try to fight back.
That's a fear shared by many across the world. A growing chorus of advocates is urgently calling for governments to take steps amid the COVID-19 pandemic to document racial information. Shilpa Venkateshwaram is with the Global Healthy Living Foundation.
We can't fix a problem that we refuse to acknowledge exists.
Not only should countries be systematically collecting racial data, Venkateshwaram says they should be collecting it in a standardized way so it can be shared with other countries.
We're a globalized world. We have to start sharing data in the interest of our communities so that we can advance our understanding of what inequalities exist in countries and also across countries.
But many countries are far from that goal. In the UK, there's evidence that people from Black, Asian, and minority ethnic backgrounds, or BAME, are overrepresented in critical care units and among health workers who have died. Still, hospitals aren't required to record patients' ethnic information. The British Medical Society called the lack of racial data on coronavirus patients a scandal, prompting this announcement a few days ago from Communities Secretary Robert Jenrick.
There does appear to be a disproportionate impact of the virus upon BME communities. And it's right that we do thorough research swiftly so that we can better understand it and then take any action that is required.
Taking action is the key, says Dr. Farah Shroff of the University of British Columbia.
It can't just be about data alone. That doesn't necessarily translate into programs that make a huge difference for communities of color.
Shroff says governments need to partner with minority community leaders to ask patients specific questions about language, cultural barriers, housing, income, employment, neighborhoods, to find out how healthcare systems should change and then make those changes. She points out that Canada has done that in the past, but thus far some Canadian provincial officials have said they have to prioritize tracking patients' ages and chronic illnesses rather than racial data. Shroff hopes they change their minds.
It can't just be enough to say racism is bad for us. That's old hat. We know that. We've got to move beyond that and really change.
Vulnerable populations have reason to be skeptical that that change will really come. Alison Tedford is an Indigenous writer and patient advocate in British Columbia.
Well, historically, we've had things like allegations of coerced sterilization. We've had birth alerts where healthcare professionals notify Child Protective Services when Indigenous children are born. There's a lot of reasons to not have a lot of trust.
Governments could take the first step in changing that by documenting the racial disparities in the impact of COVID-19. For the World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Documenting the racial disparities is important to understanding the impact of the disease. What about how the coronavirus affects the sexes?
It's well known that many diseases have different frequencies in men and women. And a lot of infectious diseases are much worse in men than they are in women.
That's Jenny Graves, an evolutionary geneticist at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia. Across the globe, more men are dying from COVID-19 than women. Graves says part of the reason might be our chromosomes, because that X chromosome, the one that women have two copies of, it has a lot to say about immunity.
One theory that's been advanced that interests me a lot is that women have an immune system that has more variance because there's a lot of immune response genes on the X chromosome. So having two copies of them is good, not just because there are more of them, but because you can have two somewhat different variants and they can actually go after different proteins.
How much is this really about genetic ability to fight the coronavirus, and how much is it about gendered behavior?
It's probably both. Almost certainly there's a big effect of behavior, and we see that with smoking incidences, for instance. There's a lot more men who smoke than women, particularly in countries like China. And so for any respiratory disease, that's bad news for men. But it's not just behavior. And we know that behavior is very culturally determined, so you would expect to get very big differences between countries. But in fact, it's remarkably uniform. It seems to be men are dying at a rate of something like 60-odd% all over the world. So it can't be just behavior.
If we turn to Italy and we're talking lifestyle, I'm thinking of kissing specifically when people greet each other and smoking. Men and women both do it. Any change in Italy when behaviors like that are practiced by both genders?
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about kissing, but I mean, that would be a very good way to spread coronavirus, I expect. I think it's been often said that it's been particularly bad in Italy because there are high numbers of older people in northern Italy, but that can't explain the sex difference because, in fact, women live longer than men, and so there are more women than there are men in the vulnerable age groups. So it must be something more fundamental than that.
What do you do with this knowledge going forward, specifically when we think about approaches to battling COVID-19? How does it help?
The take-home message is that men and women really are biologically different in many things, and one needs to look at both men and women if you're trialing drugs or vaccines, if you're looking at strategies for minimizing damage. You do have to take sex into account.
Jenny Graves is an evolutionary geneticist at La Trobe University. She's been speaking with us from Melbourne, Australia. Jenny, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Margaret.
The first known cases of COVID-19 were found in Wuhan back in December. Huanan Seafood Wholesale Market was potentially ground zero. Close contact with wild animals there has been widely blamed for the outbreak. But the produce in wet markets is a big part of the Chinese diet. Think about your own local farmers market. China is now reopening a number of them. That's gotten a lot of international criticism. Ning Dai is a PhD candidate at the University of Waterloo in Ontario. He studies food systems in China. I've heard it's similar to a farmers market in Western countries. How does a wet market actually work?
So wet markets are similar to farmers markets. The food you can expect at a wet market include fresh produce, fresh meat, and other things you can find in supermarkets. And the difference is that the wet market is not run as a corporation. It's run by independent vendors. And the vendors at wet markets in China, they're not farmers themselves. Instead, they're middlemen.
So a wholesale market would sell to wet market vendors and wet markets sell to individuals who come to shop?
Yes. In general, the wholesale markets will sell to the wet markets, and also they will sell to restaurants and hotels or other large businesses. I also want to clarify, not all wet markets in China are the same. So if you walk into a typical wet market in China that serves families, what you will see is really just fresh produce, vegetables, fruits, and the conventional animal meat. It's very uncommon for them to have wildlife animals. It's even uncommon for them to have any live animal. I think we need to be more clear about what type of market we're talking about when using the blanket term wet market.
When the Chinese hear the kind of criticism that's been leveled at the wet markets, how do they hear that? Is it culturally insensitive?
I think the overall criticism and the call to shut down the wet markets really shows that many people don't really know what the wet markets are in China. Wet markets are a very essential part of urban life. In the city of Nanjing, for example, 93% of the urban households would buy food from the wet markets. So it really shows you how wet markets are the primary source of food for urban residents.
What kind of restrictions has China put in place to minimize the risk at wet markets? And are they responding to Western pressure?
For now, the measures have been taken by the government, including asking wet markets to disinfect itself twice a day, and also to demand any person who visits the wet market to put on a face mask. The Chinese government also just passed a new law that will prohibits any trading and consumption of wild animals. So these measures are being taken to reduce the risk of the coronavirus outbreak. And in terms of banning the wet markets, If hypothetically that happens, I think it will have very bad consequences to food security and also will have very bad social ramifications that will force tens of thousands of vendors in those markets out of their job, out of livelihoods.
Ning Dai studies food systems in China. He's a PhD candidate at the University of Waterloo in Ontario. Ning Dai, thank you very much. This is fascinating.
Thank you.
Coming up, the pandemic has made all of us slow down. Some people want it to stay that way. You're with the world. Hi, this is Marco Werman. We know you value what we do here at The World. I'm asking you to demonstrate that through your financial support. Our spring campaign only has 1 week to go. That's 1 week to get your contribution matched by an anonymous donor. In order to take full advantage of the match, we need to raise $15,000 before May 1st. During these unprecedented times, our fact-based global coverage is a critical guidepost for listeners and readers. Our coverage is, and has always been, freely available to anyone who wants it. That happens because of listener support. These days more than ever, independent journalism is an important part of our democracy. We're asking for your support today. Every contribution made in support of The World will be matched, but we have to raise $15,000 to take full advantage of this generous match. Go to theworld.org/give or follow the link in the podcast notes. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Slow it down. That's what we're talking about in our weekly climate solution segment, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The idea of making cities slower or less friendly to cars has been around really since the automobile first arrived on the scene. What better time than now to put ideas into action when nobody is really going anywhere? New York City is closing some streets to vehicles, making room for runners, pedestrians, and cyclists. Here's Governor Andrew Cuomo recently.
Open streets. People want to walk. They want to go out and get some air. You want a less dense area.
Because we got to keep our social distance if we are going out into those open streets. In Bogota, the Colombian capital, the idea of kicking cars off the road isn't new. Since the mid-70s, this is what the city's busiest thoroughfares sound like on Sunday mornings. By the 90s, Bogota was shutting down 75 miles of roadway. Bogotanos call it La Ciclovía, a few hours of heaven for anyone who wants to be in car-free surroundings. With the pandemic, many other cities across the globe are following suit, including Berlin, Mexico City, and Sydney.
Bikeways and walking tracks are busier than ever as people pound the pavement, breaking the isolation boredom being felt during coronavirus restrictions.
A temporary change in unusual times, or maybe, just maybe, the new norm. Milan is thinking long term. The northern Italian city plans to build permanent bike lanes, expand sidewalks, and lower speed limits for cars. The idea of making cities more walkable, slower, has long been embraced by a network called Città Slow. That means slow city in Italian. The network spans more than 200 cities in 30 countries. Pier Giorgio Olivetti is the organization's secretary general. He's based in Orvieto, Italy.
In Italian, Orvieto means urbs vetus, old town. It is in the top of the hill. It is a castle town. And we adopted a very special project, free multi-level parkings. And we have elevators connecting the parking to the top of the hills. And the railway station of Orvieto is connected directly with the center, with the cable car and the bus. And we have also a lot of possibility for bike sharing, electric or not electric bike sharing in the town. The mix of this, also the bike lanes and the pedestrian lanes in the town, create easy living area. It's very interesting for the present and for the future of this town.
So we're focused on climate change solutions in The Big Fix. Why is slower better when it comes to the environment?
All of us are committed to find climate change solution. No, slow down era has come. It's not a choice.
it's an obligation for all earthling to be slow, because we have to consume less, to recycle, to reuse.
And do you think COVID-19 has really underscored that? You said, you know, we're already here.
Every day, many more people open their eyes. Cheetah's Law is not a religion, no? It's a more simply a practical way to moderate, to solve some problems or many problems. And we propose a sort of solutions hub, no? But we are all committed all together in many, many sectors to not forget the past, use the best of the past to put in many things and exchange the best practices. We imagine a future in which the little towns are more attractive than the big cities. One very practical approach was resilience, not only to survive, but to improve when the external conditions are changing for external reasons, for example, the virus.
Pier Giorgio Olivetti with the Cheetah Slow Network. He's based in Orvieto, Italy. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you so much.
Across the world, governments are facing a dilemma. Could the mitigation efforts to stop the coronavirus do more harm than good? Economic harm, that is. In southeastern Africa, Malawi has just over 30 reported cases of COVID-19. Malawi's government wants to lock everything down to halt the spread. Activists are pushing back. The world's Halima Gikandi has our story.
For Jane Mtika, April is one of the busiest times of year. She's a party vendor in Malawi's capital city of Lilongwe. And usually, this is when people like to book weddings.
I do wedding cakes, birthday cakes, decorations, I have tents, I hire out tables.
In fact, this Sunday, Mtika was supposed to service a big wedding. The client had already put down the deposit. Then, earlier this month, Malawi recorded its first case of COVID-19. President Peter Mutharika announced a 20-day nationwide lockdown. The order specifically said, no more engagements, no more bridal showers, and no more weddings. Mtika immediately thought about what that would mean for her livelihood.
Where am I going to get the money to feed myself, to feed my children, to feed my parents in the village because they depend on me?
Mtika says she is relatively lucky compared to other Malawians. She has a husband who can still work from home. But she says the lockdown will have a trickle-down effect on the poor and those in rural areas. She's already had to lay off 8 employees.
Instead of dying with this corona, now we'll die of hunger because we don't have money.
Mtika is far from alone with that fear. Protests have erupted across the country, with people holding signs saying, no lockdown. Gif Trappens is an activist with the Malawi Human Rights Defenders Coalition. Last week, the group took the government to court, saying that the lockdown is unconstitutional because it violates people's right to make a living.
We know that the government would want to protect Malawians from COVID-19. But at the same time, we have another problem, that is hunger that is being raised by poor Malawians who live hand to mouth.
Last week, Malawi's High Court granted a 7-day injunction that forced the government to halt the lockdown one day before it was supposed to begin. Government lawyers argued in court that officials had promised to provide relief to the country's poorest communities. But activists say those promises have not materialized.
We're just asking for the government to come up with a comprehensive, you know, measures to make sure that they're able to cushion the poor from dying of hunger.
Cushion the poor, Trappent says, just like other countries are doing, by canceling taxes, halting utility bills, and handing out food and cash. But Jane Mtika, the party vendor, is skeptical. She says she doesn't trust the government to follow through with these types of relief efforts because of corruption.
I don't depend on the government. I depend on my own. I have to work. I have to sweat so that I get money.
Mtika says it's reasonable for the government to put limits on the number of people who can gather in public. But she says that a total lockdown would kill her business. Women like her still need to earn a living. On Friday, Malawi's High Court is expected to make a final decision about the lockdown. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi.
News headlines are coming up. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Ghana has coronavirus test kits, but too few places to run the tests.
The two biggest cities have the testing site.
So for rural areas, how do you get the samples back to the labs? Enter an unmanned solution from the sky. That story's still ahead here on The World. The truth can be a bitter pill, but today German Chancellor Angela Merkel asked her country's lawmakers to swallow it.
Niemand hört es gerne, aber es ist die Wahrheit. Wir leben nicht in der Endphase.
No one likes to hear it, but it is the truth, Merkel told the German parliament. We are not living in the final phase of the pandemic, but are still at its beginning. Merkel called for international cooperation to combat the coronavirus outbreak. She said the pandemic can only be tackled if nations work together. Not many countries are looking to the U.S. for leadership in working together right now, a stark contrast to 6 years ago with the outbreak of the Ebola virus in West Africa.
Nothing like the kind of concentrated high-level effort to shake the trees and follow up with other countries and get them to contribute money. Nothing like that is happening, quite the contrary.
That's Samantha Power, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. In her recent memoir, The Education of an Idealist, she describes the marching orders President Barack Obama gave her during the 2014 Ebola outbreak.
Go to the Chinese, go to the French, go to the British. Secretary of State John Kerry doing the same. Our diplomats all around the world going to governments and hustling them to try to secure resources. And it's just the kind of global campaign that's needed now, given that developed economies, of course, are having their own severe challenges and are suffering heartbreaking losses, to still at the same time be organizing in order to help those countries that have nowhere near the infrastructure or the resources that these developed economies have. We have to walk and chew gum at the same time, because even if you're only looking at it from the narrowest, most self-interested perspective, for as long as this pandemic is raging in parts of the developing world, it's going to be very hard to restore economic normalcy globally.
So did other countries step up? I mean, what were the results of that hustle?
Absolutely. I mean, 60 to 70 countries were part of the coalition. The United States took a leadership role in the country of Liberia in West Africa. But we went to the British and said, okay, you take Sierra Leone. And the British stepped up in really important ways in a leadership role, backing, of course, the work of the Africans on the ground, which was the most important. The French stepped up in Guinea. Cuba, this tiny country with whom we were estranged at the time, we had not reopened diplomatic relations. Cuba's incredible medical professional corps was taken advantage of, and they deployed more doctors per capita to West Africa than any other country involved in the coalition. Malaysia sent rubber gloves. Japan worked on the hazmat suits to try to make them cooler.
I'm just curious, I mean, aren't there some legitimate concerns about China's approach to the pandemic, as well as its transparency, that may not allow the same level of cooperation today?
I think there are more than legitimate concerns. I mean, China's response was that of a cover-up in the earliest stages, firing whistleblowers, locking people up who tried to raise the alarm. China has a huge amount to answer to. China now, of course, is trying to rehabilitate itself in relation to this pandemic and is shipping vast supplies to particularly developing countries that don't have those supplies on hand. But many of those supplies are defective. China does not yet really work effectively at building global coalitions around what they themselves do. China is much more interested in its brand and in bilateral assistance, and not really yet in a position to or really showing much interest in leading the world.
So COVID-19 is very different from Ebola. It's often asymptomatic, and an individual can be contagious and asymptomatic at the same time. Like Ebola, though, COVID-19 represents a national security threat. I'd just love to hear from you, though, Ambassador Power, what kind of national security threat does COVID-19 pose?
Pandemic security always needed to be a top-line concern. I think it was in the Obama administration, but it's been very hard over the decades to secure adequate funding and resources. So you have heard it talked about as a core security threat, but compared to the resources deployed, for example, in fighting terrorism, it's just night and day. I mean, since 2010, the United States has spent $180 billion a year on counterterrorism operations and just $2 billion a year on pandemic and infectious disease response infrastructure. So that gives you a sense of how much more weighted America's understanding of national security has been toward hard security, counterterrorism, the military, than toward crises like this, which prove far more lethal when they strike.
Samantha Power, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, her recent memoir is The Education of an Idealist. Ambassador, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Okay, let's say a government has the testing kits but faces another challenge, how to get samples back from rural areas to be tested. In West Africa, that's a situation that Ghana is dealing with. But as the world's Lydia Emanuelidou reports, 21st century technology is coming to the rescue.
Right now, Ghana has a little more than 1,000 confirmed coronavirus cases. At least 9 people are known to have died from COVID-19. Health officials want to keep that number as low as possible, so they're ramping up testing. The good news is that right now they have plenty of test kits. The problem is getting the test samples analyzed and processed. Lydia Jankesi is a resident doctor at the Komfo Anoche Teaching Hospital in Kumasi.
We have 2 major testing sites in Ghana, that is in Accra and in Kumasi. So like the 2 biggest cities have the testing sites.
But the coronavirus has spread beyond those 2 cities to rural parts of the country. Getting test samples from the countryside to the city can take a long time, sometimes days. One of the reasons is that the infrastructure for fast ground transportation, think highways, just doesn't exist in some parts of Ghana. When trucks do make it out to rural hospitals, they often need to wait around to load enough samples to make the trip back worth it. Ghana's leaders want everyone in the country, regardless of where they live, to be able to get tests and results fast. Earlier this week, they announced a plan to expand the number of places that can process tests.
But we all know that that is not going to happen overnight. It's going to take a while.
So while it builds up its testing and processing capacity, Ghana's doing something no other country appears to be doing, using drones to get COVID test samples from rural areas to labs quickly.
About 2 weeks ago, the government of Ghana came to us and said, you know, we need help.
Justin Hamilton is with Zipline, an American company that uses drones to deliver medical supplies. Zipline was already doing some work in Ghana in partnership with the country's Ministry of Health. For about a year now, they've been using their technology to deliver vaccines and medications to hospitals around the country. Zipline's also operating in Rwanda, where they use their drones to deliver blood samples, among other things. Within about a week of the government's call, Zipline was set up to deliver samples collected in more than 1,000 health facilities across Ghana. Hamilton shared some videos of the first deliveries, which happened over the weekend, and here's how it works. First, the samples are packed in special red boxes using guidelines issued by the WHO. The boxes are then placed inside the belly of the drone, which, by the way, looks like a plane, but small enough to hold in your 2 hands. The drone's then put on a launcher, like a high-tech slingshot. And it's off. Zipline's drones are automated, but they're also being monitored and, when needed, controlled by humans. Once a drone makes it to its destination, it opens up its belly and drops the box with the samples. A tiny parachute attached to the box helps ease the landing. Once it's on the ground, a healthcare worker sprays it down with special disinfectant and takes it inside. A journey that would take hours, even days by ground, can take just minutes by drone. And using them is a lot cheaper than other air delivery methods like helicopters. Now, if the idea of flying objects packed with human pathogens makes you a little nervous, You're not alone.
There's always a risk when innovations are introduced during a pandemic like we have, right?
Wilmot James used to work for South Africa's health ministry. He's now a visiting professor at Columbia University, and he advises the African Centers for Disease Control on biosecurity. He's been following Zipline's operations for years and says the company's track record is solid. But he stressed that biosafety is critical in this kind of work.
In this particular instance, we're dealing with samples that are pathogenic. An Ebola sample is another one. You have to make sure that you have proper protocols around that.
Zipline says they've done that in consultation with experts at the WHO, and they may soon expand their wings to the U.S. They haven't been able to operate here yet because of strict Federal Aviation Administration rules, but they're currently in talks with the FAA to begin emergency humanitarian operations here to deliver PPE, personal protective equipment, and other supplies to hospitals. That work, they say, could begin in the next few weeks. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
If you've got to stay home and want to shop for something other than groceries, your options are limited, pretty much to online. Amazon has been one of the big beneficiaries, even hiring thousands of new workers to keep up with demand during the pandemic lockdowns. But not all countries' regulations on these massive retailers are the same. France, for example, it's got the fourth most reported case of the coronavirus in the world. And a court in France said Amazon is not doing enough to protect its employees. The court said Amazon must only deliver essential goods or face a fine up to $1 million. Amazon said they were protecting their employees, so it shut down its operations in France. Stéphane Angeron is the spokesman for Solidaire, one of the French unions that represents warehouse workers.
It was impossible for Amazon to prove that they were having a right protection of the workers the day of judgment. So they were saying what we were saying for weeks. It wasn't safe.
So Amazon said that it issued masks and gloves to all of its employees and implemented strict social distancing and sanitation and cleaning at its locations. Have you heard otherwise?
Yes, it is true that there were masks for employees, but there weren't enough for all of them. And above all, Amazon was saying and is still saying that they were protecting people with social distanciation. But you must imagine warehouses where there are hundreds of people working. So in reality, in fact, it was just impossible to have social distanciation in the warehouses.
How did this case against Amazon begin in France in the first place?
It began at the beginning of confinement in France, in the middle of March. As you know, like everywhere in the world, people were a bit panicked, and there were special laws that the government did at this moment, protective laws, and you mustn't gather in a place more than 100 people. And people were to go to work the same condition than before to warehouses. So they started to ask questions. They started to say, we don't have, we don't have enough alcoholic gel, we don't have enough masks, etc. And Amazon wasn't answering or saying, we will see it later. So the problem began to be an emergency. People tried to exercise their right of withdrawal, which is a right in the French law that allows workers, when there is an immediate danger, to withdraw, so not to go to work and still to be paid. It's an obligation for the employers to protect health of their workers. But Amazon said, and the law is a bit complex about it, says, no, the danger is not immediate. You have some gel, you have some mask, so you can go to work. They refuse. So they said, you can use this right if you want, but you won't be paid. At the beginning, it is a reason why we had to sue Amazon in front of a court, because they didn't want to bargain, they didn't want to listen. It was always the same answers. It's enough. What we are doing is enough.
So during this temporary shutdown, will Amazon still be providing salaries and benefits for its workers in the warehouses? They will.
Yes, Amazon will pay during the 9 days of shutdown. That's true. The point and the question for us is what will Amazon do next, because they are waiting for Friday and the deliberation, and will they ask for the state insurance of wages? For us, it is normal. It's logical that Amazon pays for the workers during the shutdown. They have enough money to do that. And the state help to enterprise in difficulty is for enterprises that are in difficulties. Amazon isn't in difficulty. Amazon is growing and is earning a lot of money during this period of pandemic for the reason we all know, so they can pay for their workers.
I'm curious, Stefan, does your union, Solidaire, does it maintain contact with other Amazon workers around the globe or here in the U.S., for example? And what are you hearing about Amazon's position toward its warehouse workers?
Yes, we do. We are in touch with workers in Poland, in Germany, in UK, in America and other countries. They are watching what is happening here in France. We've learned, for example, that three workers of Amazon in U.S. have been fired asking exactly the same thing. So we talked with them and other workers in other countries. And you must know that it isn't a struggle only for French workers in Amazon, but it's a struggle for workers of Amazon everywhere in the world.
Stéphane Enjalran is the spokesman for Solidaire, one of the French unions that represents warehouse workers. Stéphane, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
In a statement to The World, Amazon said that it is, quote, perplexed by the court's decision. The company says it's been following the French government's safety measures, but declined to comment further until the court rules on its appeal, expected tomorrow. Many refugees around the globe are living in crowded tent camps. If the coronavirus hits those places, it could be devastating. Greece has just over 100,000 refugees and asylum seekers. They're getting limited support from the Greek government, so many have come up with creative ways to help each other. Farasina Kampana begins her report in the Greek capital, Athens.
Salam, salam. Salam, Mahmoud, chetori? Khubi?
On a warm April evening, Arash Hampai is handing out pink plastic shopping bags to homeless people in Athens. Some are Greek citizens. Many are refugees. The bags are full of food and hygiene products, like soap, hand sanitizers, and face masks. Hampai is a refugee himself. He's from Iran. And he arrived here in Greece 4 years ago.
We take it there, and then they come take one by one, because we can't have a line, and they can come inside, so because of the corona.
In 2018, Hampai opened a community center in downtown Athens to help feed poor people in the city. It's called Cafe Patog, which means hangout in Farsi. Now, with the coronavirus outbreak, Hampai sees an even greater need to support refugees and locals struggling to protect themselves.
They don't have money to go to hotel to rent a house, and they don't have money to buy masks. So how they can protect themselves? Who have to help them?
Nearly a dozen volunteers, all refugees, help Hampai dole out food and supplies. Hampai isn't running a formal nonprofit, so he gets his funds for what he's doing in informal ways. Hampai pulls out his phone and shows me his PayPal account.
We have a PayPal. Yeah, they can send to our PayPal. But I will show you our PayPal. €9, €3, €2.
€2 is about $2. Hampai gets small donations like these when people hear about what he's doing. He usually has enough money to put some cooking oil, rice, and pasta in the bags.
When we have a good money, we put also sometimes meat and more things.
Hampai hums as he places the bright pink bags in a line outside the door of the community center. He lets people know they're ready for pickup by posting short videos on Instagram. Hampai has an unusual amount of freedom right now. Much of Greece has been in lockdown, including all refugee camps. That means tens of thousands of refugees can't go out for basic supplies. Suhaila Shojai is one of them. She's a 15-year-old asylum seeker from Afghanistan. She lives in Moria camp on the island of Lesbos, which is near the Turkish border. Roughly 20,000 people are crammed into a place built to hold 3,000. Like everyone there, Shojai is worried about the coronavirus.
Moria itself is a virus for asylum seekers. There's no soap, nothing. So some of us Afghan girls and women, we started working hard making masks for our people, for the asylum seekers. We want to avoid getting coronavirus at Moria camp.
Shojai and her peers are actually quite hard at work, producing more than 6,000 masks a day. They're able to do this with the support of an NGO called Team Humanity, which has been arranging weekly deliveries of mask-making materials. Salam al-Din is the founder of Team Humanity.
He says the mask-making team is able to supply each camp resident with 2 masks every 3 or 4 days. I reached him by phone in Germany.
We were distributing them to the camp with 2 pieces of soap to each person. They are reusable and people can wash it. And we gave them also a flyer where it says in 4 languages how to wash the hands, how to boil the mask. You can boil it in water if you cannot wash it, and you need to do it 2 times in a day.
So far, Moria Camp has managed to avoid an outbreak of the coronavirus. Shojayi hopes that she and the other volunteers will be able to keep it that way.
The refugees are happy and appreciate us. They said if they hadn't gotten these masks from us, then where would they be able to get them from? Here we are taking care of each other.
Recently, Greek authorities have taken steps to protect refugees and migrants. They transferred 49 unaccompanied minors from camps in the Greek islands to Germany. They're also promising to relocate more than 2,000 people who are especially vulnerable to hotels on the mainland. That includes people who are elderly or have underlying health problems. For at least some of the refugees stuck in the camps, they're turning to each other to fill whatever gaps they can. For The World, I'm Farenisa Campana, Athens, Greece.
If you've spent more time than usual scrubbing the tiles in your kitchen or bathroom, you have the 1918 influenza to thank. Yeah, I know that needs some explaining. At the turn of the 20th century, the world was being ravaged by disease, the so-called Spanish flu and tuberculosis. Around that same time, scientists were developing germ theory, the understanding that many diseases were caused by these tiny things we could not see, germs, and one way to fight them was to keep everything really clean. Home design followed suit.
The whole modern movement basically came out of how do we make our places almost hospital clean.
Lloyd Alter is a design historian and professor at Ryerson University School of Interior Design in Toronto. He says 1918 changed everything in home design.
And so suddenly you had big windows, you got rid of all the Victorian smuts and stuff that filled everybody's houses, you got an era of minimalism, and you got tiled, cleanable, washable bathrooms.
Alter says this impulse to keep everything clean explains some design choices from the period that may seem odd to us now. For example, minimalist designer Le Corbusier put a sink in the hallway of one of his most famous homes in France. A few months ago, that may have sounded crazy, but now it sort of makes sense. Lloyd Alter says those features live on in our homes, even today.
You know, we no longer put sinks right in the hall, but everybody now has powder rooms often in larger houses. They have powder rooms on the main floor right inside the front entrance.
It's not that much of a stretch to imagine that today's coronavirus outbreak could influence the way future homes are designed. Alter says we may see buildings with contactless pathways where you rarely have to touch knobs or buttons to get around. And back to our bathrooms, those may change too.
Everybody now just tries to squeeze everything in the tiniest possible space and puts the sink right next to the toilet so that when you flush the toilet, all the fecal coliform bacteria get spread around the room. I know in many countries, and I think in particular the UK, people keep the toilet in a water closet. They keep it separate from the sink. But I do believe this should become the standard of design everywhere.
Who knows? We may even see Le Corbusier's sink in the hallway take hold. What's old is new again. As for design historian Lloyd Alter, he's a man ahead of his time.
I have always had a sink in the hall. That sink of Le Corbusier's influenced me profoundly. And right now I have a sink in the hall outside the bathroom so that whenever you go by, you're reminded, wash your hands.
What I want to know is what happened in the 1970s with the arrival of shag carpeting in bathrooms. I can't even. Anyway, we'll have to tackle that one another day. Today, that's all we got time for. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Is it Friday yet? We'll see you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.